And otherwise, without further ado, today's seminar is given by Zhaoliang Xi from Stanford, and he's going to tell us about how to define effective entropy for matter fields coupled to dynamical gravity.
Okay, thanks Dominic very much for your invitation and introduction. It's a great pleasure to visit Parameter virtually. Today I will talk about a recent work about effective entropy of quantum fields coupled with gravity. So this is the paper posted this July in collaboration with Xi Dong and Santa Barbara and Zhou Xiangnan and Zhenbin Yang from Stanford. And so so the outline of the talk is here. So the motivation, so I will first explain why we try to develop this this approach to compute effective entropy in quantum fields in gravity systems. So it's mainly like providing a more solid ground for discussing entropy in systems with gravity. And then we will talk about, start from the quantum field theory entropy. We'll discuss what is different when we have gravity and what is the proposal, proposed formula, and how does that lead to phenomena like quantum extremal surface and entanglement island. And then we will discuss two examples, including one with evaporating black hole, and the other one is related to 2D geometry. And then we will discuss some random tensor network models just to help understanding better the quantum information aspects of these systems. So I'll start with the motivation. So we all know, so when you have this black hole evaporation, there is this Page curve, which says that the Hawking radiation seems to be thermal. So they seem to have increasing entropy because every bit that's emitted looks thermal. But if you believe in unitary quantum mechanics, then you can consider, for example, a black hole formed by pure state matter, then it will stay pure, which means if the black hole is totally evaporated, the entropy will come back to zero. So that leads to this Page curve. Basically, it's increasing entropy of the radiation intersect with like the possible maximal possible entropy of the black hole, which is decreasing with the decreasing size of black hole. So this is expectation based on assumption of unitarity. So we don't, previously it wasn't known like how we do this, how this is calculated in gravity theory. And so it's an expectation that the correct theory should get if it's unitary. But it wasn't like we know how to compute that. So the surprise, the exciting excitement from since last year, starting from these two works, was that there is a geometrical computation in a similar in a similar form as the Ryutaka-Nagi formula. There is some geometrical computation that gives you the black hole entropy with a Page curve. And the more precisely, what they did was in ADS-CFT, but in ADS space, the black hole does not evaporate, so you need to introduce a coupling of the ADS space with the bus. You need to couple the black hole with the bus, and the bus in their works is not gravitational. It's quantum field theory, it's some conformal field theory. And so when you couple these two, and then they show that, so you could think that the ADS space is due to a CFT on the boundary, and that boundary CFT is coupled to another CFT that's playing the role of the bus. And then they apply this quantum extremal surface formula, the generalization of the Ryutaka-Nagi formula, and show that in the late time of the black hole, there is a new surface emerging in the interior of the black hole, which is responsible for the decrease of the entropy. So that leads to many more recent works along this direction. So it seems that I won't go to more details of overviewing this recent development, But the general thing we learned is that this relation between entanglement and geometry seems to be more general than the original Ryotaro and Nagi formula and the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. So it seems like the geometry actually knows more as long as we carefully think about how the geometry changes when we do entropy calculations. It actually knows more than we thought. It knows the actual entropy rather than the coarse grained entropy of the radiation, knows these kind of things. Yeah, so then, but that brings a question, so the models, when you couple a geometrical system, a dynamical gravity, like in ADS, couples with a bath without gravity, that's a little bit artificial. So if we think about the actual more realistic system, like our universe, which is not ADS, which is the theater, or if we consider a flat space, then if we think about a black hole in this geometry, and then there is a radiation going out, we expect physically it doesn't change much, because outside, away from the black hole, far away from the black hole, the geometry is almost static, right? It's almost classical. There is some very small quantum fluctuations when we have a small G Newton. So you would expect the concept of the entropy of the Hawking radiation and the Page curve, all these things should generalize to systems where gravity is defined everywhere. But to understand that more precisely, we first need to come up with a definition. I mean, there are indeed some works this year discussing this generalization. But we feel like we need to first define what entropy are we talking about. I mean, when you are thinking of a dynamical gravity system, the geometry is fluctuating, and we don't have a Hilbert space with a tensor factor decomposition. So we need to, I mean, there are different ways you could define possible quantities that are like entropy. We need to figure out what is the right thing that we want to look at. So that's the main motivation. And then after we propose a definition, we want to study its properties. So now we start from the case we know, the situation we understand, which is entanglement entropy in quantum field theory. So in quantum field theory, we know we usually calculate entropy in replica using replica trick. For example, there is a lot of results in two-dimensional conformal field theory using this. So basically, the replica trick means we calculate von Neumann entropy by taking n goes to one limit of Rényi entropy, and the Rényi entropy calculation is done by calculating the trace of rho to the n. And so you first, let's say I have a state prepared by a path integral. Let's say you have, I'm drawing here an example of a Hartle-Hawking kind of state. I mean, what I mean is, it's here is QFT, it's not a gravity theory, but I have a curved space and with some initial conditions, and you do the path integral, you prepare the state on this circle. And then in that state, there is a region, spatial region A. So now if I want to calculate the density matrix, I need to trace over the complement, which gives you the figure, the second figure here. So you trace over the complement. So this is like bra and cat, and then trace over the complement. Then you get a density matrix of the A region. So if you do a path integral with some boundary condition on A, so this line, this blue line here means that the A region hasn't been connected. So there's two boundaries related to A, which are like the bra and cat, the two entries of the density matrix. So now if you want to calculate trace rho to the n, what you want to do is you take n copies of this picture and then connect them through this branch cut line. So then it becomes a manifold, which is the branch cover manifold of the original manifold, which means you take n copies and then cut them here and then glue them after a cyclic permutation, which means you go around and you go to the next layer. So more precisely, if you zoom in to the boundary of A, it looks like this. It looks like you go around, you go to the other layer, and after n times, you come back to itself. This is, I'm drawing here for n equals 2. So this is just like a conical singularity. So because when you go around this point, the original manifold is smooth here. So now after you do the branch covering, when you go around this point, you get 2n pi angle rather than 2 pi. like only after 2 MP you come back to yourself. So this is a conical defect. And then the entropy is just a ratio of partition functions with and without the conical defect. Here it is. Yeah. So the trace rho to the n is the ratio of partition function. So MNA is this manifold with a branch cover, and then the ZM is the partition function on the original manifold. So there is an nth power. Okay. So far this is what is relatively solid, like what we know for quantum field theory. In principle, you can do this, and it's a well-defined path integral with a fixed given background geometry. Any questions? Yeah, feel free to stop me anytime if you have a question. So now we want to generalize this to systems with dynamical gravity. Instead of fixing the background geometry like here, we want to generalize it by allowing the geometry to fluctuate. So naively, the first thing you try is you just replace this path integral on a fixed geometry by integration over geometry. And then you want to have some gravitational action which gives you a saddle point, and in the limit where G Newton goes to zero, the saddle point comes back to the original geometry. So roughly speaking, that's what you want to do. But then there is ambiguities there, like what gravitational action are you using? And how do you, once you allow the geometry to fluctuate, how do you distinguish the different, like the branch covered and not branch covered manifolds? And so there, it's also not very natural to have a separate path integral on the top and bottom, on the numerator and denominator. But, well, I can't say that must be wrong, but if you think like that analog, which has been discussed recently, the analog of this gravitational path integral with an ensemble average, then there is a difference between you take the ratio and average versus you average and take the ratio. If you are thinking of averaging over some ensemble. So similarly, you may ask whether there is similar things happening in gravity. So we want to resolve these problems. So the first thing we can exclude is if we naively just add an Einstein-Hilbert action here for that metric. That's not a choice that we want, because if you add a Einstein-Hilbert action, what happened is the picture on the right side. So originally the manifold is the branch cover manifold, which I'm drawing here. That just means you take two copies and then glue them through the cut. And so after the gluing, there is a conical defect at the red dots. So now if you are not fixing that manifold, but you are doing a path integral over the manifolds, over all manifolds like this, and with the Einstein-Hilbert action, then the equation of motion of the Einstein equation will not like the conical singularity. So it will resolve it, and the saddle point will be some other manifold, which could be very different, or at least it's very different near the conical point. So the consequence is that even if you, after that, you take G Newton goes to zero, you're not going back to the quantum field theory result. It doesn't reproduce the quantum field theory entropy we have. That's saying that we should modify the action in some way. If what I'm really interested in is to have an entropy that corresponds to the entropy of the quantum field. So the natural way to do that is to see, this is similar to like what people did in the discussion about fixed area space. So what we do is we can introduce a brain at the end of, at the boundary of A. And the role of that brain is really just canceling that conical singularity. In other words, the action we want is, so G tilde is that the metric of the branch cover manifold with the singularity, with the conical singularity. And what we want is that we add this extra term, which is proportional to the area of the boundary of A. We add the extra term just to cancel the contribution of the conical singularity in this action of G tilde. So in other words, that's actually just the action of the original manifold without the branch covering. Or you could say it's just the Einstein-Hilbert action, but not including the red dots. It's the Einstein-Hilbert action of everywhere else. And that's designed. So this action is designed such that the original saddle point is preserved. So if you, because I didn't include that contribution from the conical singularity. So if the original M is the saddle point of the Einstein-Hilbert action, then the new one, this one, will still be a saddle point of this action. Because the only difference is that extra contribution from the conical angles, and that's canceled by this area law term. So we design the action with this brain source term such that the original saddle points without branch cover, without the twist, is still a saddle point. And that's not saying that's the dominant saddle point, so that's why it could still be very interesting. This avoids the problem that even if you take the small G Newton limit, you may get something very different. It also answers the question like what's the difference between numerator and denominator. So basically, the difference is whether you put in that source. And another thing I didn't mention is we want to do a different replica trick here, just to avoid that separation between the numerator and denominator. So instead of taking like some n replicas and then divide out some normalization, some partition function, we take some n plus m copy of the system, which means instead of dividing by z to the n, we are multiplying by z to the m. And then in the end, we take m goes to minus n. So when we take that trick, then we can treat all the n plus m copies in an equal footing. So we have n plus m copies here, and in the end, we're going to take m goes to minus n. And the n plus m copies are, they are allowed to connect to each other, so it's not like factorized into multiplications of them. But there is only n of them which has this branch cover, so which has the brain. So there's n copies of them with this brain, and that brain will source that conical singularity, and then the remaining M will not have the conical singularity. And then when you, so the trivial saddle point is just the original manifold with the branch covering, and that's by design of the action, that's always a saddle point. And the question is whether there are other saddle points. Any questions about the action?
Could I ask a question? For the variational principle in ordinary gravity, if you had a codimension two surface, I think sometimes involves also a boundary term there, like if you wanted Dirichlet conditions there. Is that related to this term, or is it different? Is this term different?
I'm not very familiar with the details, but if I understand correctly, it's equivalent to if you exclude, if you look at the manifold excluding this neighborhood of this point, and then put a boundary condition there, put a Dirichlet boundary condition there.
Oh, like a codimension one.
This is a codimension two region.
No, what? But
well,
what
sorry. You exclude a neighborhood of it, so.
Yeah, so the question is, if you did that, what would be the boundary condition you're like imposing on that codimension one, you know, boundary of the neighborhood? But yeah, maybe.
I think the boundary condition is that conical angle. It means the angle is 2n pi.
Okay.
So it's codimension two. This red dot is a codimension two region. So it's like in 3D space a line, and then you have a little circle. So the boundary will be that codimension two surface times a circle. So your boundary condition will be that angle will be 2n pi around that circle.
Okay, but so in that case, would it be like the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, or is it something slightly different?
That I'm not sure.
In fact, this term is called, if I can name, say this term is called the Hayward term. So in gravity, it is well known that if you want to fix the metric on the sphere and there is a deficit angle there for a conical singularity, you have to add, it's like a term which is a bit more complicated than that because it contains the integral, the localized integral of the deficit angle over the surface. So that term is well known and well studied, that it should be added if you want to have boundaries that include corners.
So you mean the term we add is?
It's the same as the Hayward term, except that in your case, you just assume that the angle is just globally defined on the sphere, which in general is, it's not possible. It's also the same term that Redge included in the discrete Redge gluing action.
Right. So it sounds like the thing like we do is...
It's like the Gibbons-Hawking term, if you want, for codimension two.
Okay, thanks for clarifying. Yeah, my knowledge about gravity calculation is limited.
Yeah,
but it sounds like you are saying the calculation we are like the action we are doing will do what we want.
Yeah, so maybe you want to refer to this. You know, there's a lot of work on that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the clarification.
Good. Okay, so so in summary, the idea is that once we add this extra term, then we get two things we did. We add this this boundary term and we do the path integral on n plus m copies and then analytic continuity to m goes to minus n. And if you're interested in for Neumann entropy, there is another analytic continuation. N goes to one. Okay. Then we can discuss what are the different possible things that could happen here. But before that, let's talk a little bit about like how to determine the region A. Because we allow the geometry to fluctuate, so we have to fix the location of A for each given geometry that we are integrating over. So we have to fix it in a way that's gauge invariant. So there are different ways depending on what geometry you have. For example, in ADS, we could determine a region by sending in light rays from the boundary. There are other ways, like you could send in a space like geodesic and determine the location of A based on its distance to the boundary. And if you don't have ADS like boundary, if you have a asymptotic flat case, you could consider sending a light ray from far away and intersect that with a shell of matter. This is gauge invariant because once you set the initial condition of the matter, say you have some massive particles with some initial condition, and say maybe there is a black hole in the middle, and you shoot the matter out with some initial velocity, and then they will sit somewhere in the space, and we just use that as our milestone, and use that as to tell us where is that boundary of A, and in another case that's related to what we will discuss later. You can consider a universe without spatial boundary. So the spatially is like a sphere, or it's like some manifold without boundary. Then in that case, one thing you can do is you say, I'm doing path integral with a fixed spatial metric of A. Like the rest of the geometry could be fluctuating, but I only look at the manifolds that has this spatial region A with this metric. And then that will allow me to do this branch covering, all these things, because the metric is already fixed. But so as you see, these different ways does not necessarily give you the same results for general n. I think in the limit where the gravity is weak and you're dominant by one saddle point, they should give you the same results in the n goes to one limit. But in general, we don't see there is a unique way to choose the region A. I think that we are also, there are other questions like if you choose the region to be a certain distance from the boundary, then when you do a path integral, maybe some of them doesn't have that distance, and the space is small and you don't have this point available. So it doesn't seem to be a problem, because you could just means that they should, such geometry shouldn't contribute to this path integral. But it certainly tells me that the definition we are using here is, I think it's okay. The choice here we are making are well defined for geometries that have small fluctuations. But if you are thinking of like strongly quantum fluctuating geometries, we don't really know a nice way to do this.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So in the no boundary case, you picked a spatial slice and you denote a subregion A. Mm-hmm. So are you proposing to fix the metric on the whole slice or just on A?
You can do different choices, but it's probably sufficient to just fix the metric of A.
I see. Mm.
But it's well defined to fix the metric of the whole thing. But that may,
yeah.
But then it may be quite different, because you're like selecting a smaller set of manifolds to integrate over.
I see. And when you glue, you have to sum over all the metrics in the other spaces anyway, in the complement.
So if you only fix the spatial metric of A, then the remaining part could be changing. Oh, by the way, yeah, it's like we will talk about this entanglement island, which is related to like you spontaneously generate some other wormholes. But if you fix the whole metric, then that may be forbidden.
And I see.
It's possible that you have suppressed the other set of points if you fix the metric of the whole space.
That makes sense. Okay.
Any other questions? So now let's discuss what are the non-trivial possibilities here. I mean, this is very similar to the other discussions since last year. We are just trying to say that now we have a well-defined definition when the geometry is dynamical, and the same kind of phenomena appears. So like the trivial saddle point is always there, which is just taking the original saddle manifold M and then take a branch covering. But there are other possibilities, which is you could have other wormholes. Like when you create a wormhole somewhere away from A, away from this region where you're taking where you introduce the brain, and then somewhere else, there may be a new wormhole. And that's what is called the replicar wormhole. If you have that, then you will get a different result for entropy, which is we don't know in general how to do computations in that case. And by the way, one thing I didn't draw here is that you could also have more complicated, because remember, like we are doing n plus n copies. So we're doing m plus n copies. This is n. This is like n equal to 2. And then there is m copies which are not connected by the branch cover, right? So you have maybe m equal to 3, let's say. So you have some other copies. So in principle, in addition to this kind of wormhole that connect these two copies, you could also have other ones. And in principle, these are integrated over. Although we don't see a physical reason that this will become dominant in some case. In general, if we have a very complicated saddle, then we don't know how to calculate this and do an analytic continuation back to n equal to 1. But in other cases, we know there's no physical reason that you will have wormholes connecting with the other m copies. So we can treat the special case, which is when the other copies just stays at the trivial saddle, and there I am. And then this n-copy case has a symmetry, and this has a replica symmetry. So this is similar to the Rényi entropy calculation in ADS-CFT. So if you don't have replica symmetry, there could be some other more complicated things. But if you have rapid asymmetry between the different copies, then you could take a quotient. So say this, I'm drawing the picture for two copies. And so you have a manifold that's smooth everywhere except the boundary of A. And the boundary of A, the conical angles are 2 pi n. So after you do the quotient, that becomes smooth. It just come back to the original. Well, it's a different manifold that is smooth. It's a smooth manifold around the boundary of A. But in the meantime, this extra wormhole, there is a non-trivial conical angle at the end of I, because it's smooth in the manifold before quotient. So after quotient, you get this phase 2 pi over n. And this is similar to the calculation in ADES CFT case. So once you do this quotient, and then now if you calculate the entropy, well, now if you evaluate the partition function of this manifold, you get contributions from the ordinary thing, which is the quantum field theory contribution. But now because the wormhole is not at just A, but also I, so you get the entropy of AI, A union I, rather than A. But there is an extra term coming from the conical singularity at the end of I, which is this area of I. Yeah, so that's what gives you this quantum extremal surface formula that you should go away, you should go around all possibilities of I and then extremize the entropy with this formula. So because this derivation is the same as the ADS-CFT case, I didn't include more details. So is there any questions? Okay, so so let me discuss a little bit about the physical interpretation. Like, yeah, so we have shown that, okay, we have this generalization of the QFT formula, which in the simple case, when there is not much entropy, it will reproduce the trivial saddle point and give you just the QFT entropy. And in some non-trivial cases where the entropy, where this, like there is a lot of entanglement between A and I, then you could have this non-trivial saddle, which has the area law term plus the S of AI. So roughly speaking, A, if you compare with the ADS-CFT case, so it's like generalized. So in the ADS-CFT case, there is a boundary region A, and then there is a bulk entanglement wedge of A. And then you are looking at the extremal formula where the RT surface is like the boundary of the entanglement wedge. So here it's like an analog of that, but A is a bulk region, and I is also a bulk region. So the question is what entropy are we actually calculating? So in the QFT case, we have a density operator and then we define the von Neumann entropy. We're calculating the entropy of that density operator. And here, if the geometry is fluctuating, the degree of freedom of matter is following it. We don't really have a definition of that density operator. At least not in the sense of a standard quantum mechanics density operator. So a priori, it's not clear what entropy this is. But one practical thing we can say, I feel like we are more comfortable saying, is that we can say this is still some measure of how much correlation there are in A. So you can relate entropy to correlation functions. And the correlation functions are still well-defined. Even if I have geometry fluctuations, as long as we choose the region A in a gauge invariant way, we can also choose positions in A in a gauge invariant way. And then these correlation, the expectation value of operators in the quantum field theory, these are still well-defined. And so let's say I have a family of operators TA. So these are Hermitian operators in the QFT, in the A region. So in addition, I could choose TA such that it's a complete basis. And so I can choose, for example, like if I have a lattice model, like a finite dimensional Hilbert space, then this will be like all the Pauli matrices and products of them. As if I have a family of qubits. So in the QFT case, that space is infinite, but we always have a cutoff. So we always choose a cutoff in energy. And then you have an orthonormal basis of operators on that Hilbert space. So now if you choose that basis, you can prove that the purity, which is the e to the minus s2, the second ring entropy, that's actually just an average over one point function. So like you take this orthonormal basis of operators and then calculate their expectation value, and then the average of them will be the purity. So there is a similar formula for higher ranges. It's a little more complicated, but it's just some kind of average of the one-point function and two-point functions of this orthonormal basis of operators. So what I want to say here is that as long as these expectation value of operators are well-defined in the gravitational path integral, you could still do this. You could define our entropy as some measure of, on average, how strong is the correlation, right, of A with complement of the system. So that seems to be a way to say that even if I don't know the definition of the density operator, this entropy is still a physically well-defined quantity. Any question?
Yeah, actually. So would that then include this sort of brain you introduced, or like this counter term for your conical defect, or like is that implicitly included in the operator if you do this?
When I calculate the expectation value of the operator, I am doing the original manifold, so I didn't introduce the.
Okay.
So the interesting thing is that after you sum over them, like the reason why, so this picture on the right side, that's saying that summing over a complete basis of operators, let's say the case of S2, if I draw this picture for S2, then what happened is that you take two copies of the system and then sum over a complete basis of operators. That's the same as swapping between the two copies. So the same, if you do this kind of sum, then you get a cyclic permutation of n copies. So that's saying like this together, like when you sum over all these operators, that actually is the same as inserting that twist operator. So when you calculate this for each operator, you don't insert that brain, which gives you the branch cover. But the effect of summing over all these operators actually gives you the effect of that twist.
Okay, thank you.
But I think that means that when I, more precisely, like when I think about this in a gravitational system, I shouldn't be like calculating this. I shouldn't be like calculating each term in the gravity system and then just product over them. It should be like there is a metric for each copy of the system, and then you are integrating them together. But there is also the other m copies which are not doing anything here. So it's just expecting a value of one, and then you should integrate over g. I think it's because otherwise you won't have any wormholes connecting the different copies.
I have a question. Yeah. You still have to determine what is this algebra of operator A, right? In quantum gravity, this is really the crux of the matter. Nobody knows how to define it. So it is a definition, but it pushes the problem onto something which is even more intractable.
These T's here are just the quantum field theory operators. It's not like the operator algebra for the whole theory, including dynamical gravity.
I thought you were, so you're not proposing these things for quantum gravity then?
The title is quantum fields in dynamical gravity, which means, it's a system with dynamical gravity, but this entropy is measuring how much information is in the low energy quantum field. The reason why I'm showing this relation between the Rényi entropy and the average expectation value of operators is it doesn't require these T's to form an algebra. So it requires a linear space of operators. So I choose an orthonormal basis over it. But what I need here is just for each given metric, for each given background geometry, the quantum field theory operators in the A region on that geometry, that forms this linear space of operators here. I didn't require that to discuss how to put them, like put the different, like the geometry, the operators on different geometries, how to put them together.
Okay. And the integral of the metric is which metric, the boundary metric or the bulk metric?
It's the bulk metric. And so for each metric, for each manifold, for each manifold, we need a gauge invariant weight. For example, let's say this. We discussed several ways to fix the region A. So let's say I have I have a system without boundary. Then I fixed A by choosing the metric of A. Then the remainder of the system still have a metric that's fluctuating. And so then the operators in A are just ordinary quantum field theory operators. So we have quantum field theory operators in A with that fixed geometry. So just 1 point, 2 point, 3 point functions of the matter fields. And then the complement could be fluctuating. That's what we are integrating here.
It is still the crux to be able to define what you mean by averaging of a metric. In some sense, that's the core of quantum gravity problem. Give a proper definition of what it means to take expectation value of metrics.
So this one here, this one here is just done in QFT with a given metric. And then there is the averaging over a metric here, which is, I agree, in general is very hard. But the point is that the summing over the orthonormal basis of operators gives you that twist operator, gives you the operator that cyclic permute the quantum fields. So basically, this is just saying like only using knowledge about QFT, like the fact that there is an orthonormal basis of operators in QFT, so that when you sum over this equation here is really just orthonormal condition. It's saying you take two copies of the QFT, and then if TA is an orthonormal basis, then sum over TA, which means that sum over TA. Say alpha, beta, gamma, delta is something like this. So that's just orthonormal condition. So I didn't use any knowledge about gravity here. And then what you do is that's just showing that when you sum over these family of operators, you just get back the e to the minus xn, which is written as you can also write it as expectation value of a cyclic permutation operator in n copies of the system. And that's where the gravity comes in. And that just come back to this calculation here. And so it becomes this this path integral with that the boundary term that gives you that cyclic permutation operator between different copies is equivalent to inserting this brain. Okay. Yeah, so it certainly doesn't solve the most general quantum gravity problem. If I'm writing down this path integral with the Einstein-Hilbert action, I mean, this by itself, how do I define this non-perturbatively? That's certainly a much harder problem. It's saying like, in the cases where gravity is weak and we know how to like evaluate the saddle point of this this kind of path integral, then we have the entropy defined here, and we have an interpretation that relates it to some average, some kind of average over the QFT operator expectation values. Yeah, I guess it means that as long as the QFT operators for each given geometry is defined, we can define this quantity. We don't need to worry that how do I compare the operators on different geometries and how to make them together into a bigger algebra.
I have a possibly naive question. So if you have if you're starting with the closed universe case and you have the full theory as fluctuating metrics and fields, matters coupled to it. I'll ask the question after I formulate it a little better.
Okay.
Just a minute. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll ask a little later.
Oh, okay. Okay, so one further comment about the physical meaning of this formula. So you see from this expression that the entropy SA here is actually dependent on UV cutoff at the boundary of A. So that's not a problem for me. I mean, but I understand that there's some other questions about entropy in gravity systems, which is like, how do I define something that's UV complete and independent? So this entropy will not be something like that, because it depends on the UV cutoff you choose. And that's the same as the QLT case. So that's why I think it's physically correct to have that cutoff dependence. Like when we define the QLT entropy of A region, that's divergent. And you always need that UV cutoff. And physically what that means is that there's infinite degrees of freedom in QLT, but we will get a finite entropy only if we focus on the degrees of freedom below certain energy scale. And the same is true here. But one interesting comment is that it doesn't depend on the UV cutoff at the region I. Like this extra island, in terms of QFT entropy, you are just calculating the entropy of A and I together. So they are seems to be on equal footing. But there is an area law term which is only for I. So if I change the UV cutoff, let's say I assume I could change it locally, then I can change the UV cutoff around I. Like I'm integrating over some high energy modes, but only in the neighborhood of I. Then that may reduce the QFT entropy if I only look at the lower energy part of I. But these higher energy degrees of freedom, after you integrate them out, they should modify G Newton and enter this area law term. So both terms depend on cutoff, but the sum should be independent from the UV cutoff of I. This has been discussed in the CFT case where I is like the RT surface. Like there is a cutoff dependence at the actual boundary, like the region of the boundary region, so the boundary of the boundary region A, but there is no UV cutoff dependence in the bulk. It shouldn't be like UV divergent. And later when we discuss the tensor networks, we will see there is a similar feature there. So I think that's physically meaningful because when you for A, like when you look at the degree of freedom in A, when you have this entanglement island, you actually degree of freedom in A, there is no real physical difference between the area law contributions from I and other contributions of entropy from I. It's just a separation of it's just a matter of integrating over a higher energy degrees of freedom and give you an area law term. But there is a physical difference between what degree of freedom you included in A and what you didn't include. And by the way, there is another comment I want to make is you see from this extremal surface formula that this island will only be possible if the QFT entropy in I exceeds the Bekenstein entropy bound. So because the SI is according to some general inequalities in entropy, Si will be bigger or equal to this entropy difference between A and A union I. And that's exactly the contribution of the area law look at the left side. So the contribution with I, with the entanglement island I, is this entropy. And the contribution of the trivial saddle point is the Sa. So if the non-trivial saddle point has a smaller entropy, then this difference must be bigger than the area law, which means the entropy of I itself must be bigger than the area law. So this is really something that only happens when you have this QFT degrees of freedom that have an entropy that exceeds the area law bound. Any questions?
Could I ask quick question on that?
Yeah.
Are you saying that could the existence of an island depend on the cutoff at A? Is that something like whether or not you have an island could depend on that, or is it a weaker dependence?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the dependence, I mean, I would expect it doesn't. Like I can't immediately prove it never depends on the choice of cutoff in A, but because the expectation is if I change that cutoff, I'm changing an area law term of A. So I'm not expecting to change a lot of long range entanglement between I and A, then I don't expect it to change the location of the island.
Okay,
But like if your cutoff is very low in such that like above the cutoff there is still some degrees of freedom that are long range entangled with things far away, then there could be an untrivial effect.
Okay, thanks.
So if one is considering a closed universe and fix a region A in a spatial slice of that universe, mm-hmm. then since all operators are space-like separated, do they all commute?
You mean the operators in I and A?
No, the operator is just in A, for example.
The operators in A for different locations, yes. They should commute, yeah.
I see, okay.
Just like in ordinary QFT.
That's right, yeah, okay.
Yes. But then there is the interesting question about how like operators in I, are they independent from A or not? And this is something I will come back to in the discussion about tensor network.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, so let's briefly look at some examples. So maybe I will be very quick here. So we studied some external black hole geometry. The reason why we started eternal is just because it's simple. And I will, this is not too much, qualitatively, this is not much different from other recent works where they studied some 2D models. I think most of these reference here studied a 2D model. And we studied a 4D Schwarzschild, because we only look at SVO mode, and that's described by a 2D CFT. We are ignoring the gray body factors. So the calculation is actually 2D. So the only different thing we did is that we look at this cross call, like the eternal black hole in the cross call coordinate. But you shouldn't calculate in general, we don't know how to calculate the energy momentum tensor and calculate entropies in a generic state of this 2D CFT. So instead, we just study like states that we know how to do, which is some states you get by well transformation. You start from vacuum in some metric and you do a well transformation, and then you get an untrivial energy momentum and you get some entropy, which you know how to write down. And then there is a choice, right? So you choose different coordinates that gives you different states. If we just choose that cross call coordinate, which is a capital U and capital V here, then that's actually not a very consistent case, because in that case, when you sit far away, you don't get a vacuum. When you sit far away from the black hole, you get a finite temperature thermal state. Right? So you get a finite thermal state in a flat space, which has a finite energy density. And then that means that the energy is very high, and then it's not consistent that we are ignoring the back reaction. We are ignoring the back reaction to the metric and still look at the same metric. So instead we look at a different metric, which is related by this, by the capital U and V with a arc-sinh transformation. And when you use that metric, then what happens is most of the system, it becomes vacuum. So physically, I will skip the details. Physically, what happened is this picture. So like this is a state in this 2D CFT, which is like vacuum in this the green regions, but there is an energy current going out at some finite value of U and V. So it's that state. And so then it's consistent to assume like when the central charge is small, I can ignore the back reaction because it's just some local change. You don't have like this diverging, very large region with a finite energy density. And then you could calculate the island, right? Just look at the extremal surface formula, the quantum extremal surface formula. And then you find the island is somewhere inside the horizon. So it's given by this picture. It's inside the horizon and it's like scrambling time away from the boundary region. From the region A boundary. So region A is defined by like the outside, the exterior of a shell around the black hole. So So when you calculate that entropy, that induces an island inside, and the island is a little bit is the scrambling time log g Newton minus log g Newton earlier in the u coordinate, and it sits inside. So the state is indeed different from like the calculations in the eternal black hole in ADS case. Now, there was a work last year Princeton group. So the eternal black hole case, the island is outside. And so here you see like somehow when I have a infinity which is vacuum, then island goes into the interior. But other than that, mostly it's confirming the same kind of physics in the previous works. And then there is the other example we look at is a two-dimensional case. So we basically design a simplest case that we can study. And then the case is that you do a path integral on a Euclidean ADS with matter and with the gravity. So it's like a JT gravity with matter. But then we interpretate this circle. So this usually you say this defines a state on the disk. But instead of calling that a state, we interpret that as a density metric. So we view the red half as bra and the green part as cat. So that's well defined, right? So that's like you already traced over the complement. Maybe you should think of the half disk as a state, and then you trace over the middle, then you get the density metrics of the other half. So that's a definition of the density metrics. And then when we look at the replica geometry, there is different possibilities. The trivial possibility is just separate disks, and the non-trivial one is you have a single, it's like a wormhole. You have a single region connecting the two boundaries. So this picture in the middle is like the n equal to 2 case where you have two boundaries, and then you should take n goes to one limit, and after you take n goes to one limit, it basically goes back to the original geometry, but with the possibility of having an island in the middle. And because of symmetry, it will sit in this line. So then you can just optimize, and you find that indeed, like this, whether you have the island depends on the choice of the central charge and the boundary length. So there is something like a Page curve here. Like when you have a lot of matter in the system, you have a lot of entanglement of the matter fields, then it prefers there is an island. And so physically, what is the interpretation of this? The state. So physically, it's basically, I mean, it's like we don't have a very precise interpretation, but the conjecture is that this looks like a Sweckian model turned sideways. What I mean is that, many of you know, that there's a Sweckian model, the Safidov-Yerkes model, which is approximately due to a JT gravity and ADS coupled with matter. And there's fermions coupling to it because there's fermions in that Sweckian model. So in that case, there's a 0 plus 1 D boundary. Right? So if I think about Euclidean time, then it's the same picture here, but the circle direction, the angle direction is interpreted as time. So now we have the same thing, but we want to interpret it as space. And we need some degrees of freedom living on the space. So in the SYK language, it's like SYK model coupled with source term. Like SYK model coupled with a source fermion here. And that source fermion lives everywhere at every imaginary time. And then you look at this partition function of SYK with the source, like the source of psi at time zero, psi at time delta tau, and so on. And so you look at the SYK model with the source, and then you say that defines density metrics for the source field. And so this if you look at this wave function, it actually is what people call the continuous matrix product state in kind of matter. So it's like a matrix product state where the matrix is given by the SYK time evolution. And actually viewing in this point of view, it's not surprising that the entropy has this Page curve behavior. Yeah, it just means that the matrix product state never has an entropy exceeding how much bound dimension you have here, like how much entropy you can pass through the auxiliary degrees of freedom. So here the SYK degree of freedom chi is like the auxiliary degree of freedom. So that's why like the entropy has an upper bound. Like when you have a matrix Fermilab state with a small physical dimension, then you can have an entropy that's growing. But then when you have too many physical degrees of freedom, then the entropy is bounded by how many virtual degrees of freedom you have. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so since I'm going over time, I will just quickly sketch the second part, which is the random tensor networks. So basically, the tensor network models are some toy models, and then in the case of ADS-CFT, you can think of a tensor network that tiles the hyperbolic space, and then you should view them as a map from bulk degree of freedom to the boundary. So the bulk degree of freedom is indicated by red lines here, and the boundary is the black line. And in ADS-CFT, we are in the limit where the red line has a low dimension and the black one has a higher dimension. So you're mapping the bulk degree of freedom, which we call QFT. You map the bulk degree of freedom to a much bigger boundary cube of space, and that mapping is an isometry. And so a lot of the nice properties like quantum error correction the bulk qubit from boundary, these are all consequences of this mapping. So you can reconstruct degree of freedom from the bulk to the boundary, and that reconstruction, also you have a local reconstruction. If you have an entanglement wedge, then degree of freedom in the entanglement wedge can be mapped to the boundary with an isometry. And you can reproduce the quantum extremal surface formula. The difference is that there is basically no back reaction. It means you have this formula already for the Rényi's with the same geometry. That's the main difference from the holography, from the ADS-CFT case. And so for simplicity, instead of drawing the complicated networks, let's just look at three tensors. That's enough for us. So we just think about the bulk. This represents the bulk geometry. There are three tensors, and every tensor is a random state. And then you take the bulk matter and map it to a degree of freedom on the boundary. But so what's the difference when we try to generalize to more general geometries? So first of all, the tensor network states has a nice property that you could just draw it on any geometry. So the definition of it doesn't rely on ADS. And so there was some earlier works about tensor, more restricted tensor networks, which requires a hyperbolic geometry in order to have Ryota-Ganagi formula. But the random tensor networks, you actually don't need that. You can just have any geometry and you can prove formulas like the RT formula with quantum correction. So it's well defined on general geometry, but the key difference is that you lose this property of isometry from bulk to boundary, because your boundary could be arbitrarily small. There may not even be a boundary. So the question is, what is the interpretation of this general tensor network? Like, for example, you could have no boundary, in which case you just take degree of freedom in your bulk quantum field theory, and you project with the tensors, and you're left with a number. So that seems to be saying that, like in a closed universe without boundary, the tensor network gives you just one number. It means it gives you like a Hilbert space with dimension one, which seems strange. But if you think about correlation functions, it's probably still okay. Because like even if I only have one number, then I could still insert operators. I could insert some operators in the bulk degree of freedom and calculate their correlation functions. And the difference from the case with a big boundary is that this is like a post-selected quantum mechanics, because physically it's like I prepare the state of the quantum field theory and then I apply some operators. And after that, instead of tracing over the state, I apply these random tensors, which are like random projections. It's like local random projection. And after you apply these projections, if there is a boundary, then there is some degree of freedom left, which is this line here. If there is no boundary, then you're left with just a number. So the general, so as a consequence of the post-selection, the general correlation function is a function of a pair of operators. Like originally, if I am thinking about a region A, then look at the one-point function of arbitrary operators on A. Here, it will be a pair of operators, because because applying an operator on the left side of row of the density matrix is different from applying it to the right side, because there is a final state projection there. So this means that if we want to define entropy, I also have to take care of that, and I define a bigger density operator. This is what we call the super density operator, which is basically just leaving the leg open here. And so you have a tensor network, and then you're leaving this line of A open. But because you have to do that on both sides, the density operator is actually double the dimension. Like if A has a dimension D, the density operator has dimension D squared. And in this interpretation, the entanglement entropy we can calculate is like entropy of one of them. Say you can see this more clearly in the case without boundary, which is that the entanglement entropy looks like an entropy of one copy of A with another copy. And the other copy is like the one connected to the tensor network. Anyway, so the point is that once you calculate that entropy, you can show that there is the same kind of island formula, and that can be mapped to an Ising model calculation. But I want to skip all the other ones, but just to mention that the one thing we can study more explicitly in the tensor network model than the geometry case is we can construct the operator reconstruction map. So the question is, when I do the entropy calculation, and the entropy calculation tell me there is an island, so the entropy is given by the entropy of AI plus the area law term, which is represented by this line L1 here. So does that mean that everything in I, like all the operators in I, can be mapped to operators in A? The answer is no. If we do this, we can calculate some mutual information and tell us that it's not like all operators in I you can reconstruct in A. The correct statement is you could take I and do a small perturbation unit, which means like, let's say I is a big region also and has many qubits. If you perturb a small part of it, only a few qubits, then you can show that no matter where you probe there, the mutual information with A is maximum, which means operator like that, the operator P here, which only accepts a small part of I, that can be mapped to A with an isometry. So any operator that's small on I can be mapped to A. And small means that you could neglect its effect on the entropy calculations, like the extremal surface formula. These things are not modified much by this small perturbation. So that's the operator reconstruction. And the last thing is that if you consider a closed universe, there is something very peculiar, which is if I have a closed universe with pure state matter, it seems like not only I can reconstruct operators on the island in A, I could also reconstruct operators in the complement of the island with a different map. So the interpretation of us is that because there's only like one state in the closed universe, so what happened is I is part of A. So if you do a small perturbation in I, that's equivalent to doing some complicated operator in A. But if you do a small perturbation outside the island, also outside A, that's like operating on some qubits that are maximally entangled with A. So that's why the operator can still be pushed to A, but there is a different ordering of operators. So I will end there. Yeah. In summary, the purpose of the paper is to propose a general replica calculation that gives us this this generalization of the effective field theory entropy in geometry in system with geometry fluctuations. And there's a lot of questions posted by how we understand it, especially when we look at the tensor networks. So one question I want to mention is in particular whether quantum gravity is from like a post-selected quantum mechanics. This is also suggested from earlier works like the final state projection model of black hole. But the tensor network discussion here seems to suggest that that's more general. Like, In general geometries, this post-selection seems to be playing an important role, especially in the extreme case like the closed universe. Then basically everything is projected. Okay, I will end there. Thank you. Sorry for going long.
All right. Well, thank you, Chao Yang. That was a great talk. And we already had a bunch of questions. I guess we have more time for questions. Unless I hear something else from AV. So are there any more questions? Okay, I don't see any question right now, but then maybe I can ask a quick question. So you've discussed this using random tensor networks, right? But assume you don't like this idea of ensemble averaging, then I guess something like tensor network representation of like a quantum error correcting code, which doesn't include some random component, would be like, you know, good to have a look at. Did you think about this at all, or do you have anything?
You mean generalizing that to the generic case?
Yeah, I mean, taking, I guess, like the happy code or something and looking at it in this respect?
Yeah, no, I haven't studied that. Yeah, that's a good question. I expect, as I said, I mean, indeed, there is this key difference. Like the happy code case, they prove the RT formula, and the proof requires the hyperbolic space. Mm-hmm. So it's a flow, and it requires no quality of curvature. And so in the random tensor network case, you prove the problem is you have random averaging, but if you do the averaging, then it becomes like a partition function of a spin model. So the RT formula will apply even for general geometry. So that means we cannot do that kind of isometry flow in the general geometries, in the general geometry case, because the positive curvature. Hmm. But if you really take a code like that, my expectation is the properties is actually very similar to here. It's just maybe more difficult to prove.
I see. Okay.
We can only prove things like in a large bound dimension limit of the random tensor network. But we also have some numerics before. I think the even the Q-tree tensors used in heavy code, these are already having very good properties. Like, it's just we don't know how to prove them. But I think they are almost as good as the random tensors.
Okay, I'm just going to ask again if there's any other questions. Okay, then I'm just going to stop the recording and see if there's any more questions after that.